Hello, and welcome to the New Books in Philosophy channel of the New Books Network. My name is Robert Talese, and I am co-host of the channel along with Carrie Figder. In our bi-monthly podcast, we talk with philosophers about their newly published books. Today, I'll be talking with Professor Alan Buchanan about his new book, Better Than Human, which was published a few months ago by Oxford University Press. Alan Buchanan is James B. Duke Professor of Philosophy and Professor of Law at Duke University. Buchanan begins his book with the following observations. It's too late to just say no to biomedical enhancements. They're already here, and more are on the way. According to Buchanan, the question is how we should respond to these facts. Some philosophers want to pretend that we can just say no to enhancements, whereas others promote wild-eyed fantasies of a post-human technological utopia. In Better Than Human, Buchanan pursues the dual objective of criticizing both of these camps and then proposing a sensible middle way between them, contending that there is no point to being anti-enhancement in any wholesale way. He seeks a view of biomedical enhancement that can effectively manage the moral risks inherent in the enhancement enterprise. Consequently, Better Than Human offers a philosophically compelling roadmap to the enhancement debates, while also sketching a realistic approach to the moral and political issues. So let's turn to the interview. Hello, Alan Buchanan.
Hello. How are you?
Good. How are you doing today?
I'm fine, thank you.
Excellent. Thank you so much for joining us on New Books in Philosophy. And today, on New Books in Philosophy, I'll be talking to Alan Buchanan about his new book, Better Than Human, which was published a few months ago with Oxford University Press. Better Than Human is a concise and tightly argued book that addresses the moral and political issues surrounding emerging human enhancement technology, including biological enhancement technology. The book is lively and engaging, and in my view, offers a thoroughly sensible approach to these important issues. So I recommend it highly. But before we get into our discussion of Better Than Human, Alan, why don't you take a few moments and tell us a little bit about yourself?
Well, thank you. I started out in philosophy in a completely different area. I worked on Kant's metaphysics and epistemology, and then one day the chairman of my department came in and said, there's a chap on the phone from a neonatal intensive care unit. I'm not sure exactly what that is. And he says he wants some ethical guidance. And you're sometimes think about ethics, don't you, Alan? Why don't you call him and talk to him? Well, I did. And I ended up being an advisor on a neonatal intensive care unit for ethical issues concerning severely compromised newborns, termination of treatment decisions. And I found this very fascinating, and I started looking into the bioethics literature, and I didn't find much that I agreed with, so I started writing. And then someone noticed my writing, and I was asked to be a staff philosopher for the President's Commission on Medical Ethics in the early 1980s in Washington. And that got me further into bioethics, and things just sort of took off from there. There was never any planning about this. But always at the same time, I was working in political philosophy. And I think it's been somewhat of an advantage for me in bioethics that I look at many issues from the standpoint of a political philosopher and tend to think in terms of institutions and in terms of power relationships. And I think that's beneficial almost always in looking at bioethical issues. And I think that in this book that we're talking about, Better Than Human, that comes out pretty clearly. I think that most of the people who participated in the enhancement debate have not really been able to look at things very clearly from an institutional standpoint or from a political standpoint, and they tend to think of it more in terms simply of individual ethics, where the individual is making a decision considered an abstraction from any sort of institutional context.
Right. Can I ask, just again, just a a little bit more biographical information. So one of the really interesting things about your work, Alan, is its breadth in a way. So you've done really remarkable work in political philosophy, but also you've done, in addition to the bioethics work, but you've also done stuff in international law and human rights law and the concept of human rights and even some issues in social epistemology. Do you see all of these issues as hanging together around some central concerns, or do you see looser relations between them?
It's interesting. Often when I start working in a new area, I don't initially see much connection to what I've done before. But as time goes on, I see more and more connections, and it's turned out to be very fruitful, I think. I think that my work in any of the areas that you mentioned has benefited from work in other areas. I'd like to mention another aspect of my work that might not be apparent to some of your listeners. I've been fortunate to combine theoretical work with practical work, especially with policy consultation, really at pretty high levels, not just with the President's Commission on Medical Ethics in the 80s, but with all of the subsequent presidential medical ethics commissions and some other bioethics commissions that weren't presidential commissions. I've played a role in all of them in one way or another as a consultant or as a staff member. But also in the area of political philosophy, I've had the good fortune to actually engage with people in the real world who are making important decisions. I consulted with the transitional government of Ethiopia in 1993,
right,
the writing of the secession clause in their new constitution, and I was asked to do that because I had written a book on secession. And I've also consulted with the Council of Europe's High Commissioner on National Minorities on issues of self-determination and autonomy. I've consulted with the Canadian government on possible secession of Quebec, and was asked to write a response to a Canadian Supreme Court ruling on that issue. And this has just been something that I couldn't have anticipated at all when I went to graduate school in philosophy. When I was in graduate school in philosophy in the early 70s, there really wasn't much in the way of a developed field of practical ethics or applied ethics. And it was really almost unheard of for philosophers to have the kind of opportunities that I later came to have. So I guess you might say I have a short attention span or stimulation, but both the breadth of philosophical topics that I've worked on and this back and forth move from the theoretical to the practical has really made for an incredibly interesting career for me. And I can't say that I've done this out of a sense of duty or try to promote the greater good. It's just been a lot of fun.
Right. Well, that's excellent. And, you know, there's a lot of talk in our profession about the need for philosophers to publicly engage and all the rest. But often that's just a lot of talk, but not in your case, which is quite refreshing. So let's turn to the book. OK.
Yes.
I want to ask sort of a very general question before getting into the actual nuts and bolts of your positive views. So one of the tasks that you set for yourself in Better Than a Human is in part to provide for your reader what we might call a roadmap to the debates over human enhancement. And it is a complex set of debates rather than just a single question. And I was sort of moved or intrigued by one of the claims very early in the book, where you describe the debate over human enhancement not as between pro-enhancement and anti-enhancement, but rather between anti-enhancement and anti-anti-enhancement views. And this, by the way, strikes me as the right way to describe a lot of philosophical debates. I take it that you think that the debate has this structure because, as you say, even on the first page of the book, I'm quoting you here, it's too late to just say no to biomedical enhancements. So there's no, they're here. It's not the kind of thing that we can, in some simple way, just say yes or no to. Now it's a question of whether philosophically we think this set of phenomena that are here is a bad thing, or if we think that it's not yet clear that it's unequivocally a bad thing. So why don't we begin then with you telling us a little bit about the philosophical terrain of these debates.
Good. Yes, you're right. I think it's important to stress this point that I think that the real division in the debate is between anti-enhancement people and anti-anti-enhancement people. And the anti-enhancement people seem to be advocating a kind of blanket rejection of biomedical enhancement technologies. Now, some of them are a little more nuanced. Perhaps Habermas is one of these. He restricts the blanket rejection perhaps to genetic alteration of human embryos for the sake of enhancement. But I think someone like Sandel and also Leon Cass are people who hold a more sweeping anti-enhancement view. They don't seem to think there are some kinds of biomedical enhancements that are permissible or perhaps even good. They seem to reject the whole idea, the whole enterprise. And then I think the other main parties to the debate mainly are people who want to reject the view that no enhancements are permissible. They want to reject the blanket anti-enhancement view. And then they have different views about which sorts of biomedical enhancements under which circumstances might be permissible or not. Now, what I find problematic about the debate as it's structured in that way is first that I think that the anti-enhancement arguments are extremely weak, that in fact the people who advance them don't seem to know the difference between advancing considerations against enhancement or some forms of enhancement or some forms of enhancement or circumstances on the one hand versus arguments against enhancement, where an argument is a set of premises that culminates in the conclusion that enhancements or this kind of enhancement are wrong or morally impermissible. Instead, they just sort of raise some cons, some negatives, some concerns about enhancement, and then act as if they provided an argument against enhancement, an argument, in fact, for rejecting all modes of biomedical enhancement. On the other hand, the anti-anti-enhancement people leave me unsatisfied as well, for the most part, because often they say things that, although they have the ring of truth and perhaps common sense, are not very action guiding. They say, well, it's wrong to reject all enhancements. Sometimes enhancements will be permissible. The anti-enhancement people are right that we need to be cautious. So the right thing to do is just to go slow and discern which enhancements are appropriate and which aren't, but then without really getting very concrete about what that means. So what I wanted to do was both, on the one hand, make a very strong conclusive case that the anti-enhancement position is wrong, that it's wrong to reject biomedical enhancements across the board. But on the other hand, to go further than the usual anti-anti-enhancement positions and say more clearly which kinds of biomedical enhancements under which circumstances would be problematic and which wouldn't, and give some concrete advice that is more specific and helpful than just sort of general cautionary remarks to the effect, don't go too far, go slowly, proceed with caution. And one of the things that I think is valuable in the book is that it really does provide some specific cautionary heuristics, some rules of thumb about how to be responsible in pursuing what many people take to be the most problematic and risky kinds of biomedical enhancements, namely those that involve altering the genomes of human embryos. So that's right. The way I see the anti-enhancement versus anti-anti-enhancement debate. And I must say, and I'm pretty straightforward about this in the book, I find the current state of debate very disappointing. I mean, this is an incredibly important issue. And it's an issue not just for philosophers, but for all thinking human beings. And as you said earlier, enhancements are already upon us and more are on the way, so we can't evade the issue. But the quality of the debate has been, I think, very low in many cases. And I think in particular with the anti-enhancement positions, that the arguments just aren't there. There are, as I said, considerations, but there's nothing like well thought out arguments. And it's a little bit of a puzzle as to why some of the anti-enhancement authors like Sandel have apparently been so influential, or that their why their work has been accepted as valid by many people. And I think it has to do not so much with the quality of the arguments, which I think is low, but with the fact that people have very uneasy feelings about technologies generally, and perhaps about the rapid pace of change in modern life. But they especially have serious concerns about biomedical technologies. And I think somehow Sandel and Cass and others have tapped into those concerns. I don't think they've represented them very clearly or constructively, but there really is something there. And I've tried to exhaust different interpretations of what the anti-enhancement people say to try to get at what's really bothering people. And right. The readers will have to be to judge themselves how successful I've been about that. But I don't want to convey any idea that I think there are no problems here. I really think they are. There are serious problems. My main concern in the book is to try to winnow out the bogus concerns, less serious concerns, and get at what the most serious concerns are and state them clearly, and then try to offer some practical advice about how to cope with them.
Right, right. So, I want to get to talking about both some of the specific diagnoses you offer of the anti-enhancement views, and to talk a little bit about these rules of thumb for managing the risks of enhancement. But let me ask one other sort of more preliminary or general question. Could you say something about the variety of enhancements and the distinctions that you think are worth making between enhancements of different kinds? It seems to me that it's helpful, and in the book you do a lot of this work to get clear on the scope of the concept of an enhancement.
Good. I'm glad you brought that up. This is a good time to do that right at the beginning. Well, the definition of enhancement that I give is a pretty widely used one. I don't think it's terribly controversial. The idea is that an enhancement is some deliberate action aimed at producing an improvement in some existing human capacity, or perhaps more radically, even creating a new human capacity. Now, the thing to notice about this definition is, first of all, that it doesn't limit enhancements to biomedical enhancements. Biomedical enhancements, as I understand them, are attempts to improve human capacities or perhaps create new human capacities through using biomedical technologies that act directly on the body or the brain. Mm-hmm. Now, there are other kinds of enhancements that aren't biomedical. I also distinguish between different modes of enhancement and different types of enhancement. One type of enhancement that's very important is cognitive enhancement, that is, improving the cognitive capacities of human beings. And I point out that we've been doing this for a long time before we had biomedical technologies. Literacy is a fantastic cognitive enhancement. It enables us to perform cognitive tasks that we could never perform before. Numeracy or mathematical techniques are also another very important cognitive enhancement. And you can view science as an enterprise, as an institutionalized enterprise, as a kind of collective enhancement device. Right. I think it's important to keep this in mind because sometimes people, I think, go a bit off the rails by making the mistake of thinking that biomedical enhancements are something entirely new, forgetting that much of what we call human progress has been a matter of getting new enhancements of one kind or another. So that's the first thing. Now, I mentioned that there are modes and types of enhancement. By types of enhancement, I mean enhancements that produce different categories of increases in capacities, like cognitive enhancements would be one. Affective enhancements, enhancements that improve our emotional capacities or our motivational capacities would be another. Of course, there can be physical enhancements of stature or of physical endurance or speed or dexterity. And there can be enhancements of our resistance to diseases and perhaps eventually enhancements of our capacity for living longer. So those are a bunch of different types of enhancements. And then there are different modes of enhancements. For a particular type of enhancement, like cognitive enhancements, there can be several modes. As I mentioned, there are low-tech modes of cognitive enhancement, like literacy. But among the biomedical modes of cognitive enhancement, there is the administration of drugs. And we already have cognitive enhancement drugs. We've had them for some time. Caffeine is a cognitive enhancement drug. Nicotine is a cognitive enhancement drug. Now it turns out that a fair number of students, especially at elite undergraduate institutions in the United States, are taking drugs that weren't designed for cognitive enhancement, but they do, in fact, produce cognitive enhancements. These are drugs that were initially developed to treat attention deficit disorder, symptoms of Alzheimer's dementia, and narcolepsy, or uncontrolled going to sleep. And drugs in each of these three categories have been shown to have improving effects on some cognitive tests in normal people, people who don't have narcolepsy or Alzheimer's or attention deficit disorder. But there are other modes of cognitive enhancement that are possible. Perhaps there will be eventually genetically engineered brain tissue implants, or there may be nanocomputer implants into the brain, or interface technologies between the brain and computers. We already have those. In fact, there are some interesting experimental devices that have been developed mainly to help people who've suffered some sort of brain damage. For example, damage to their visual centers, their optical nerves that are unable to see, and they can be given a kind of artificial substitute for vision by connecting computers appropriately to the brain. And I mentioned earlier a much more radical kind of biomedical enhancement mode, and that would be genetically altering human embryos so that as the embryo divides and subdivides and divides again, eventually the genetic changes that were engineered into the embryo are replicated in all the cells of the human body and result in this case, perhaps cognitive improvements. So there are types of biomedical enhancement and modes of biomedical enhancement. There are non-biomedical enhancements and biomedical enhancements. I think once we begin to see these distinctions, it increasingly looks foolish to say that we should reject all enhancements or even all biomedical enhancements. We have to be more fine-grained than that. We have to look at the type and the mode, and we have to look at the state of the technology, how safe it is. We have to look at the social and institutional context in which the technology would be applied. And we may also have to look at the values of the individuals involved.
Right, right. So this is very helpful, and it does seem to me that when we have a set of phenomena that are so complex and there are so many distinctions at work, that you're almost guaranteed to be correct when you say there can't be correct to offer a wholesale yay or nay to this very complex and complicated package of things that we've got to get our hands dirty in the trenches. So let me turn to a couple of the diagnoses that you offer of how the anti-enhancement position has gained traction, because I think that, again, if we're talking about a very complex set of phenomena, it's hard to imagine a wholesale no or a wholesale yay could possibly fit the bill. One of the diagnoses that you offer with respect to the debate as such, and one of the respects in which you see the debate as disappointing, is that you think that especially the anti-enhancement views are sort of hampered with what you regard as an inadequate grasp of evolutionary biology. And it seems that certain strands of the anti-enhancement position draw on, you allege, notions, for example, of nature that have at their core some pre-Darwinian commitments. Could you tell us a little bit about the role of getting a good grip on evolutionary biology plays in improving the character of the debate?
Yes, thank you. I mentioned earlier that I think one distinctive contribution of the book is the focus on institutions and providing a sort of political philosopher's perspective. The other main distinctive valuable thing about the book, in my opinion, is that I really do take evolutionary biology seriously.
Right.
And I think most people in the enhancement debate don't. And to give an idea of why I think it's so important to do that, I'd like to just quote from Charles Darwin in a letter to his friend Joseph Hooker.
Great.
And I'd like you to, the listeners, to consider what the implications of this description of nature by Darwin, the father of modern biology, what the implications are for how we should think about the possibility of biomedical enhancement, even when the enhancements would in some way involve changing our nature or interfering with nature. Here's the quote from Darwin. "What a book a devil's chaplain might write on the clumsy, wasteful, blundering, low, and horridly cruel works of nature." Now, that's pretty strong stuff. We all remember the quote from Alfred Lord Tennyson about nature being red in tooth and claw. Well, Darwin says it's not just bloody, it's inept.
Right.
It's extremely inept. That's why Darwin really should be viewed as the person who dealt what should have been the death blow to the idea of intelligent design. He doesn't think that evolution produces intelligent designs. He thinks it's really quite a mess. Now, if you think of nature in that way, then the idea of changing nature or even changing our nature doesn't look so wildly irresponsible. Right. On the other hand, if you have a pre-Darwinian view of nature, if you think that nature, including human nature, is somehow benign and that it's the work of a master engineer, either God or evolution, but understood in a kind of pre-Darwinian way, then you'll think of it as, you know, the works of nature, the human organism, as being these stable, completed, harmonious, well-functioning entities. And then, of course, any proposal for changing that will look foolishly irresponsible.
Right.
But once you begin to realize just how flawed the works of nature are, including us, then at least it makes sense to take seriously the possibility that we might want to intervene in these natural processes and even intervene in some ways that could change our nature. Now, one of the things that I find interesting and in a way depressing about the enhancement debate is that although there's a lot of talk about nature and human nature, especially on the part of the anti-enhancement people, this talk about nature and human nature is remarkably naive, given how problematic these concepts are, and given the fact, especially with regard to the concept of human nature, that many intelligent people in the history of Western thought have said foolish and wrong-headed things about human nature. And yet you get people like Sandel and Cass and President Bush's Council on Bioethics, of which they're both members, talking as if we know what human nature is. We have a kind of a priori access to it. We don't have to look to what science tells us about human nature and about human nature as part of nature as a whole. And instead, you get these rosy, teleological, pre-Darwinian notions of nature and human nature. And then that stacks the deck against enhancement of any kind, because it makes it look as if someone who's proposing enhancement is a kind of foolish, wildly hubristic individual who doesn't appreciate this wonderful harmony, these completed, perfected, finely balanced works of nature. So I think the place to start is by taking evolutionary biology seriously. And I've been aided in doing this because the philosophy department, of which I'm a member, is rated number one in philosophy of biology. And so I have excellent colleagues and graduate students who have very generously engaged in extensive and intensive tutoring to bring me up to speed on knowing what I needed to know about the basics of evolutionary theory in order to approach the enhancement issues in a more informed way.
Right. And so that's excellent. So let me sort of raise what I take to be a kind of second plank in your diagnosis, or a second move, one that's not, it seems to me, dependent on the stance you take with respect to the relevance of evolutionary biology. So it seems to me that one of the other moves that you make is to argue that the anti-enhancement views fail to consider the possibility, and in many cases it looks to me like an obvious actuality, that enhancement might be necessary in order to preserve the status quo. Now, it seems to me that that's a powerful argument, because if you're right about the what drives the sort of naive view of biology that drives some of the anti-enhancement views, that sort of don't mess with Mother Nature, things are in some sense as they should be, and so any intervention is going to involve some kind of moral loss, or at least moral risk, it seems to me that it's really important and a very crucial aspect of your argument against the anti-enhancement view, that there are all kinds of respects in which, if we do nothing, if we don't, as it were, mess with Mother Nature, things are going to get worse. And that in all kinds of respects, the kinds of enhancements that you're talking about, even the more radical forms of enhancement, might be required in order to preserve or to keep pace with where we are.
Yes, that's right. I'm so glad you brought that up, because I think that's a distinctive message that I'm adding to the enhancement debate. The anti-enhancement people think of the pursuit of enhancement as the pursuit of improvement relative to the status quo. And actually, in a more extreme way, Sandel thinks of the pursuit of enhancement as the pursuit of perfection. He says at one point that enhancement, what's really wrong with enhancement, is not the risk of unintended bad consequences. It's that enhancement represents the Promethean drive for mastery. Now, I think this is just obviously false. There may be some people who would pursue some enhancements in some context, of which it would be correct to say that they're striving for perfection. But in many cases, if you're pursuing an enhancement, you're just pursuing an improvement of some existing capacity, an improvement, not perfection. For example, when I had LASIK surgery on my eyes, to my surprise, my physician asked me if I wanted 20/20 vision or a little better.
Right. You mentioned this in the book.
I opted for a little better. But I wasn't opting for perfection. I had no delusions that I could have perfect vision, whatever that would be. I'm not even sure it makes sense to talk about perfect vision. There's good vision for different tasks. So the first mistake is that some anti-enhancement people confuse the pursuit of enhancement with the pursuit of perfection. But then if they're more reasonable than that and say, well, it's the pursuit of improvement relative to status quo, it may not be. There may be some cases where we need to enhance a particular capacity just in order to prevent our situation from getting worse. And here I have recourse to a favorite quote of mine from one of my favorite novels, The Leopard by Lampedusa. Right. The Leopard is a wonderful book about what the meaning of conservatism is, about how hard it is to be a conservative, to know what to do if you are a conservative. And at one point in the book, there's a wonderful statement by one of the characters, Tancredi, who says, if things are going to stay the same, things will have to change.
Right.
And that may in fact be the case. I mean, it's been true in the past that human beings or our pre-human ancestors had to change in order to prevent their situation from getting worse. They had to adapt to some new environmental problem. Well, presumably we'll have to do that in the future. And in some cases, we may be able to adapt more successfully if we can use biomedical technologies to enhance some of our capacities. So it's just a mistake to say that enhancement is only valuable for the sake of improvement relative to the status quo. It might turn out to be necessary just to preserve what we value most, to prevent us from getting into a much worse situation. And after all, we produce problems for ourselves in the process of solving other problems. This is the history of human beings.
Right.
And we've done a number of things to mess up our environment, for example. And it may be that in some cases in the future, in order to cope with problems we've already created, we may have to modify our capacities. So I think that's another blow against the anti-enhancement position. It's not just that they're wrong in rejecting enhancement across the board, but there's a sense in which they don't really even understand enhancements. They limit the value of enhancements to improvements relative to the status quo. That's a fundamental mistake. And once you realize that it's a mistake, it changes the whole character of the enhancement debate.
Right. And may even, in fact, logically force anti-enhancement or certain versions of the anti-enhancement view to embrace certain kinds of enhancements. Because after all, what drives the anti-enhancement view is the status quo is exactly as it should be. Well, then if you can show that enhancement is necessary to preserve that, then it's hard for them to have any, point to any ground on which they resist those kinds of enhancements.
That's exactly right. By the way, let me just interject here. At a conference on enhancement at Harvard a few years ago, the very astute philosopher Francis Kahn asked Sandel if he would approve of an enhancement pill which would make people more appreciative of what they have, which would enhance their capacity to accept the unbidden, to accept the giftedness of their current condition, which Sandel's always going on about. And Sandel admitted that he was stumped on that, that he would have to get back to her. I think it's been years. I don't think he has gotten back to her on that. But that's another illustration of how it might be that from a conservative standpoint, the standpoint of somebody who wants to preserve what we have, like our character, for example, if you think character is worth preserving, I have some doubts about that myself, as a generalization. But it might be necessary to enhance some capacity in order to preserve the kind of virtuous character that Sandel thinks is imperiled by the prospect of enhancement.
Right. I had I should just mention that the story about Frances Kahn was wonderful. I had a course with her many, many years ago. And I could just, she's such a sharp mind in precisely that way. I could just actually hear that question in my own mind coming out of her mouth in a way. But let me try for a moment now to play devil's advocate. With all due respect, Michael Sandel is not the devil. But let me just try to say something or try to try out a response on behalf of Sandel and just see your reaction. Because I wonder whether your criticisms of Sandel might not be missing at least an element of maybe a crucial element of what's driving his version of the anti-enhancement view. Now, let me preface this by saying that, the claim that enhancement debases us or somehow tarnishes our character, the point that all enhancement is really a manifestation of some very disreputable drive for perfection rather than just a drive for making things better. Some of the language that Sandel uses, the drive to mastery, the unbidden, the recognition of the gift. I'll grant that all of this is problematic, and I don't want to defend any of that at this point. But and here's the devil's advocacy. Maybe Sandel has a point, at least in the following respect. Maybe what he's concerned about is that enhancement technology, especially of the biomedical sort, so the more high-tech kind, brings under the scope of human control a range of phenomena that were largely outside of our control. And maybe the next thought is that, I mean, that seems to me almost definitionally true, right? That's what an enhancement is. But maybe the next thought is that with increased control come all kinds of increased modes of responsibility, more opportunities for wrongdoing, more opportunities for hurting, you know, setting people's life chances back. And so maybe what drives the Sandel view is the thought that the attempt to take control over things that we previously didn't have control over reveals some kind of vice, that is, reveals some kind of maybe pathological interest in leaving nothing to chance.
I think you're onto something. I would sort of separate two things. I was with you completely until the last. I think it's certainly true that whenever we extend the range of control over anything, over ourselves, over our environment, then we get new responsibilities, because if we're able to control outcomes, then if there are bad outcomes and we can avoid them, at least there's a prima facie case that we should try to avoid them. So we can come to have new responsibilities as our power increases. Now, I think this has been the story for a very long time. And I think that in most cases, there are burdens that come with responsibility. Responsibilities, if you discharge them, that requires cost of some kind to you or to someone. Mm-hmm. So that's a consideration. And you can get it wrong. You can fail to fulfill your responsibilities properly. But when you think about human progress, often it's involved an expansion of the realm of control. And if you think about something like the modern welfare state, and not even necessarily a very robust one, but the assumption is that within limits, poverty and lack of access to education and restrictions on opportunity due to serious medical problems, that these are now things over which we can exert some control, and that we have obligations, and that ultimately the obligations should be discharged, at least in part, through the operation of the modern state. Now, in the past, before the rise of the modern state, I think in many cases, people just didn't even think of things like poverty as being something that could be greatly reduced or eliminated by human actions. And partly it was because they didn't understand the origins of poverty, but partly it was because they were right. There just wasn't the institutional capacity to take the kind of coordinated action necessary to make a significant impact on poverty. So it's true that once we expand our powers, we have new responsibilities, but that's not necessarily a bad thing, and it doesn't necessarily exhibit any kind of vice of the pursuit of excessive or unlimited mastery. Now, I think that there is such a vice, and in the book, I talk about there's a chapter in which I look at character concerns, at worries about whether the availability of biomedical enhancements will somehow corrupt us, exacerbate whatever character flaws we have or some of us have. And I think that's Sandel's unique contribution, is that he's focused on character concerns. I just don't think he gets it right. As I've said, I don't think that the desire to exert more control in a certain area necessarily means you have an unlimited desire for total control. And there's an passage in Sandel where he says, you know, if we go down this route of biomedical enhancements, then the ultimate end of this is a situation in which we have nothing to contemplate but our own will. And I find this to be a bizarre thing to say, because even if we had many more biomedical enhancements, and they were much more effective than I think they're ever likely to be, there would still be vast areas of human existence which were not within human control.
Right.
There would still be unpredictable wars. There would be swings of the market. People would train for jobs which disappear. People would be would unexpectedly fall in love with inappropriate people. Parents would try to raise their children one way, and they would turn out just the opposite. There would still be the weather, natural catastrophes. I don't think we're, you know, there's any prospect of a lack of control shortage in human life. And yet Sandel talks as if there is, and that biomedical enhancement is pushing us toward this dire shortage. Now, I think that, I think there is a vice of you know, trying to exert excessive control. And again, I sometimes find works of literature to be the best illustration of this. In Stendhal's novel, The Red and the Black, the main character, Julien Sorel, is somebody who is constantly trying to control everything. Right. He's trying to operate in the strategic calculating mode all the time. And the results are disastrous. And the author makes it very clear that this is not the way a human being should live. It doesn't leave room for spontaneity, for one thing. It shows a kind of delusory idea that you can control everything, but also it doesn't appreciate the cost of constantly trying to control things. You mentioned one cost, that is we get greater responsibilities and responsibility to burdens, but there are other costs too, including the loss of spontaneity. So I think it's quite true to say that if we had a really wide menu of powerful biomedical enhancements to choose from, that all of us may run some risk of overdoing it and of getting too involved in trying to exert more and more control and missing out on enjoying what we already have, missing out on spontaneity, failing to appreciate the benefits of some things not being under control. Mm-hmm. And it might be that some people would not just run this risk, but the risk would be realized and they would lead very bad lives. And this would be facilitated by the availability of biomedical technologies. But of course, there are people like that who already lead very bad lives,
right,
through other modes of indulging this vice of striving for excessive control. Now, here's where we come to the point that I made earlier. There's a difference between a consideration against enhancement and an argument against it.
Right.
And I think that it is a valid concern to worry about whether people may overdo the enhancement enterprise and thereby lose some important goods like spontaneity and like not always being in the future-oriented calculating mode, but being in the present, being able to appreciate what you have. I think that's important, and I stress that in the chapter that I referred to. But it's a huge leap from saying that to saying that we should reject enhancements across the board because they represent the drive for mastery.
Right.
If there's a problem with the drive for mastery, and I think there is, it doesn't just apply to biomedical enhancement, it applies to all technologies. It really applies to all human action directed toward gaining some kind of control over ourselves or over the environment.
Right. And fascinating. I mean, this seems to me to strike the right notes. But let's move on now, if we can. I think that there is a further sort of move open to Sandel, because I take it that what drives his set of concerns, and maybe you're right, at the end of the day, this is not a case against enhancement. It's really Sandel offering a set of warnings about enhancement, or a set of concerns, as you put it. But maybe the situation gets a little bit more or further complicated when we're talking about enhancements that some group of people are choosing to introduce into the lives of others. So I take it that part of what drives him is the sort of designer baby kinds of concerns. I don't know how plausible that is, a description of what the technology is capable of, but I take it that that's sort of the choosing for others, or the chooser, the trying to be in control of the conditions of others' lives is a worry of his. Maybe things get more complicated, but
I think they do. And I think obviously it's one thing to choose to try to enhance yourself. It's another to choose for somebody who can give no consent to it, like your offspring.
Right.
I think that does raise different kinds of issues. But I think Sandel, again, is overly broad. He tends to talk about parents who would want biomedical enhancements for their children as if they are all sort of super competitive, perfectionistic people whose only desire for the enhancement for their children is to make their children more somehow competitive against other children. I think that's an unfairly unflattering picture. I think that if you look at other kinds of enhancements, like cognitive enhancements, I mean, Sandel teaches at Harvard. Lots of people send their children to Harvard, not primarily because they want them to beat other children in competitions, and certainly not because they think it will make them perfect, but simply because they value the kind of cognitive enhancement that a Harvard education can give. There are cases of hyper-parenting, of excessive desire for mastery or perfection on the part of parents, but I think it would be a mistake to overgeneralize from that and say we ought to reject the enhancement enterprise entirely, because that overlooks the possibly great benefits that we might get from enhancement. And also, it overlooks the possibility that some people, under the right circumstances, may handle enhancements reasonably well. And it's not clear to me why they should be penalized for the fact that some other people won't handle enhancements right. well.
Right. So this gives us a nice segue into one of the other sort of main moves more in the positive direction of laying out your own view, where you do take very seriously what we might think of as not the character concerns about enhancement, but the justice concerns about enhancement.
Right.
So could you tell us a little bit about this? Because you have both, again, a diagnostic move with the anti-enhancement views. They tend to see enhancements always in these competitive terms, always a zero sum, mm-hmm. And always as not only initially expensive, but forever expensive and available only to the wealthy. So could you tell us a little bit about the justice dimension of the enhancement debate?
Yes, well, I do take the problems of justice very seriously. I was a first author of a book called From Chance to Choice that appeared in 2000, which is devoted to questions of justice as they're raised by biomedic technologies, especially ones involving genetics in one way or another. So I think that's a really serious issue. But I think that the current enhancement debate has really misframed the issue to a large extent, especially on the side of the anti-enhancement people. They tend to view the benefits that would be derived from biomedical enhancements as purely personal goods. That is, the benefit only redounds to the person who gets the enhancement. And they tend to view them as zero sum. That is, if you get an enhancement and I don't, the benefit that you get from the enhancement is going to be offset by a corresponding disadvantage to me because I don't have the enhancement. So the first assumption they make is that biomedical enhancements will be purely personal and zero-sum goods. The second assumption, as you mentioned, is that they will be very, very expensive. And so if you put these two assumptions together, you get a pretty unfavorable picture from the standpoint of distributive justice. Some people, the people who are already better off in other ways, will have access to enhancements, and the benefits they get will actually worsen the condition of those who are already worse off, so worse off that they couldn't afford the enhancements. That's a pretty grim view.
Right.
Now, it's not clear if that view were true, what follows from it. Some people just sort of throw up their hands and say, well, we should reject enhancements. I think that's unrealistic. As you said earlier, we already have enhancements. There's going to be powerful forces in favor of developing more of them. So I just think, you know, just say no isn't a good answer. But I also think the diagnosis is wrong. Certainly there are circumstances in which enhancements would have this zero sum aspect, but there are others in which they won't. And I think focusing on cognitive enhancements is a good way to appreciate this point. And also I think cognitive enhancements, especially through the use of drugs, cognitive enhancement drugs, are probably the most realistic prospect for significant biomedical enhancements for the foreseeable future, not things like genetically engineering embryos. Cognitive enhancement drugs or biomedical cognitive enhancements, like other cognitive enhancements, tend to have network effects. That is, the more people have them, the more valuable they are to the people that have them. If you are the only person who can read and write, the benefit you get from literacy is pretty limited. If there are tens of millions or hundreds of millions of other people who can read and write, then literacy is much more valuable to you. Similarly with having a computer, if you're the only person who has a computer, you know, you can play solitaire, you can do things like that, but there won't be any internet because there won't be other people with computers. There won't be any email. So I think cognitive enhancements generally, whether they're biomedical or otherwise, tend to have this feature of having network effects. But also they tend to have another feature that makes them not zero sum, and that is they can increase productivity in the broadest sense. They can enable us to do things that we couldn't do before or that would have been too costly for us to want to do. And this can improve everyone's welfare under certain circumstances. Now, I'm not naive. I don't think that increases in human productivity automatically translate into widely distributed increases in human welfare. But I do think it's pretty uncontroversial that major improvements in human welfare over the long historical stretch have usually proceeded on the basis of some increase in productivity. And it's not just productivity in sort of an economic sense, you know, bigger GDP, something like that, or bigger GDP for less effort expended. It's also a richer life. It's new kinds of activities that are intrinsically beneficial. I mean, the analogy I like to use is between the card game of Go Fish and Bridge.
Right. Okay?
There are some enjoyments that you can get from playing Go Fish, but if you're able to play Bridge, you're not going to find Go Fish to be very satisfying. It's not very demanding, and the pleasures of it are correspondingly much more limited. It might turn out that in the distant future, if human beings are very cognitively enhanced, that they'll look at a lot of our social interactions in the way that you and I, if we can play Bridge, look at people who are just playing Go Fish. I'll say, well, you know, that's sort of sad that they weren't capable of these much more intrinsically rewarding activities that we're capable of. And that's quite apart from the economic benefits, the welfare benefits of having large numbers of cognitively enhanced people. Here's another analogy. You can think of the scientific community as a group of cognitively enhanced individuals. They have better epistemic rules. They have better practices for assessing evidence than the average person does. And as a result, they're able to produce all sorts of benefits, many of which the rest of us can enjoy, that they couldn't if they didn't have this kind of collective cognitive enhancement. So that's the first point, is that we shouldn't think of enhancements, especially cognitive enhancements, which are likely to be the most important ones for the foreseeable future, as purely personal goods, zero sum. They'll have wider social benefits, and they'll have network effects, at least in many cases. The other assumption people make is that biomedical enhancements are going to be very expensive, and they tacitly assume they're going to remain expensive. Right. Now, we can take the case of cognitive enhancement drugs. When drugs go off patent and can be produced generically, the price takes a huge dive. At Walmart now, there are, I think, over 125 drugs that were formerly patented and very expensive, and you can get a month's supply of each of them for $4.
Right.
Now, if we have safe and effective cognitive enhancement drugs, they go through the patent period, they become generic, there's no reason to think they shouldn't be priced in a similar way. And that means they would be cheaper than getting a cup of coffee at Starbucks every day for a month. So I think it's a mistake to think that the prices are going to remain high, these things are going to remain unaffordable. When you think of other technologies like cell phones, when cell phones were first developed, I think most people thought they were going to be sort of expensive toys for the better off.
Right.
And the proliferation of cell phones has been fantastic beyond what anyone dreamed. Now there are poor illiterate peasants in, you know, rural Pakistan who are organizing their economic activity using cell phones and also organizing politically. So it's not always true that new technologies are or remain expensive. And also, whether they remain expensive is partly up to us. It's not a fact of nature. It has to do primarily with what the character of our intellectual property rules are. And in one chapter of the book, I look at some possibilities for coping with the problem of unaffordability that's due to monopoly pricing by patent holders.
Right.
So again, I think the conversation has been, it starts out in the right way, but it doesn't go far enough. It makes problematic assumptions about the nature of these goods, and it simply takes unaffordability as a permanent fact and as something that's not amenable to some modification by the right kind of social policy.
Right. So this provides a good occasion to ask you about these rules of thumb for managing the risks. So I take it that one way to sort of summarize your view in Better Than Human is to say that it makes no sense in a way to be pro or con enhancement. Enhancement is a fact that we're going to have to contend with, or that we have to contend with now. And your argument against the anti-enhancement view is that it's got a naive, maybe in the most general sense, it's got a naive understanding of where we are, as if you could just be anti-enhancement. And I take it that the positive message is the enhancements are here, and some of the considerations that get raised by the anti-enhancement crowd are serious considerations, but they don't rise to the level of objections as such. And so the philosopher's job is to think of ways to manage the risks that we're taking on in light of this fact of enhancement. And so one of the nice moments in the book comes sort of like halfway through it, right around page 96, where you give us seven sort of rules of thumb by which we may sort of manage some of these risks. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yes, I will. Let me first say that there are really sort of two paths that I take for trying to provide guidance for coping with the risk. One is what you just mentioned, and in particular, these rules of thumb or cautionary heuristics are for what I take to be the most problematic case of biomedical enhancement, namely genetically altering human embryos. And I'll get to those in a moment. The reason I chose those as the ones for which I developed these heuristics is that that's the toughest case. If you can provide some reasonable cautionary principles for that very tough case, and presumably other cases of biomedical enhancement will look like they're even more amenable to reasonable right. risk management. But the other strategy that I take for providing a way of coping with the very real risks of biomedical enhancement is with this idea of the enhancement enterprise.
Right.
So I'd like to contrast two different ways that we might go for the fork in the road as we move into the age of biomedical enhancements. One is the route that the anti-enhancement people want us to take, and that is at least to sort of try to reject biomedical enhancements across the board and to view the pursuit of biomedical enhancements as illegitimate. And what this would mean in practice would be, for example, if we notice that college students are using drugs off-label for cognitive enhancement purposes, drugs that weren't developed for that purpose, then we make this illegal. We try to put teeth into sanctions against it. We describe these people as vicious, as exhibiting vices, etc. Now, I don't think that's well-founded ethically for reasons I've already described. I also think it would be futile. It's not likely to work. It's just would drive the activity further underground, raise prices in the way that prices have been raised by making a number of recreational drugs illegal. And of course, that would just exacerbate whatever distributive justice problems there are, right? I mean,
right.
About unaffordability, the first thing to do, if you really want to make it unaffordable, is to declare it illegal and the kind of activity that we shouldn't approve of in society, et cetera. The other path is to reject the blanket anti-enhancement view and say that enhancement can be a legitimate pursuit, that it can even be admirable under certain circumstances. But instead of just letting enhancements in through the back door as under the table spinoffs from developments of treatment the way they've been so far, you recognize enhancement itself as a legitimate activity. And then, say, in the case of cognitive enhancement drugs being used by students, you allow drug companies to produce cognitive enhancement drugs as such, and you develop double-blind clinical studies of longitudinal sort that really tell us whether these drugs are safe and how effective they are for whom. You can't do that if you've branded the whole enhancement enterprise as somehow illegitimate and unseemly and driven it underground. So I think paradoxically, if you're really worried about problems with enhancement, the first thing you should do is reject the anti-enhancement position. Recognize that enhancement is not only inevitably here, but that it can be done in ways that are quite respectable. And then bring it into the public sphere and try to manage and regulate it appropriately.
Right.
It should become an object of public policy, and it should be viewed as something that's happening, it's going to happen, that it can have some good effects, but that it also has some risk. And then it can be in a position where we can make decisions about how important investment is in biomedical enhancement technologies relative to other social goods. If we continue to let it in through the back door, it may become quite a powerful force in society, and it may draw off a lot of resources from other potentially more valuable or equally valuable investments, but there really won't be any way to cope with that. Whereas if it's brought out into the open, we can at least have a chance for deliberative democracy, about which you've written a lot, to work and to say, well, what are the trade-offs here? You know, how much should we be investing in these technologies compared to technologies for preventing or treating disease, or for education, or for cleaning up the environment? So I think our best prospect is, if you're really worried about risk, is to bring this thing out in the light of day and make it an object of public policy and of reasonable risk management. But the other more specific strategy is the one that you mentioned. That is, if you take the toughest case, the case where it looks like the risk might be the greatest, a particular mode of biomedical enhancement, namely genetically altering embryos for the sake of enhancement, the first thing to ask is, well, how should you frame the risk issue? And I think the way to frame it is to think that the risks are the risks that are involved in ontogeny, that is, in the sequence of events from the conceptus through the development of the embryo to when the individual is born and then the process of development unfolds. And that means we have to look at it scientifically, and we have to ask, before we even start thinking about cautionary heuristics, we have to ask what the state of our knowledge is about those ontogenic causal processes. And we need to know whether our limited knowledge is likely to expand. And if it's likely to expand, then there won't be one permanent set of cautionary heuristics. In other words, you need cautionary heuristics that are knowledge sensitive, both in the sense that they really take seriously the limitations of our current knowledge, but they're also capable of being modified or replaced with other cautionary heuristics as our knowledge increases. And presumably, an appropriate set of heuristics shouldn't be knowledge blocking. It shouldn't be something that prevents us from getting greater knowledge, which, if we achieve it, would make it more reasonable to engage in certain interventions. So if I may, I'll just give an example of some of the cautionary heuristics, again, that would apply to this very particular dramatic biomedical enhancement of trying to genetically alter
embryos. Yeah, please, please.
I'll just read a couple of them. First, the intervention should target genes at shallower ontogenic depths, or to use a different aquatic metaphor, genes that get switched on further downstream in the developmental cascade.
Right.
This makes sense because the consequences of the mistake in the case of a gene that does its work upstream in the process, nearer the beginning, is likely to have greater ill effects. Upstream errors have a cascading effect, so other things being equal, we should avoid interventions upstream.
Right.
Here's the second one. The intervention, if successful, wouldn't produce an enhancement that exceeds greatly the upper limit of the current normal distribution of the trait in question. Suppose the trait is intelligence as measured by IQ's tests. If some people already have IQs of 140 and looks like they're doing okay, then we're on safer ground making a genetic change that will result in an individual who would have an IQ of who would have had an IQ of 120 having one of 140 instead. Then we would be in making a change that results in an individual with an IQ of 240, which is higher than anybody has ever had. Now, eventually, we might gain enough knowledge that we could make interventions that would target enhancements that would go above the normal range. But at least at the beginning, this would make sense. Here are two other quick readings of cautionary heuristics. The intervention's effects are limited to the organism in which the intervention is perform. This is important, but relatively easy to accomplish in the case of mammals like us. One of the big worries about genetically modified crops is that modified seeds can escape from experimental plots. Fortunately, human eggs, sperm, and embryos aren't like that. They don't get blown around by the wind, and they can't hitchhike on the fur of passing animals or in the digestive systems of birds. Another cautionary heuristic. The intervention's effects stay compartmentalized within the organism. In other words, the intervention modifies a highly modularized system or subsystem. This reduces the chance of unintended spillover effects. Further, one last crucial cautionary heuristic. The intervention's effects are reversible.
Right.
If this condition is satisfied, ongoing damage can be avoided. Reversing bad unintended effects would be accomplished in a number of different ways, by drugs that counteract the effects of gene expression or stop the gene from expressing in the first place. Those are two examples.
Right, right. Well, this is really, really fascinating stuff, Alan, and we could, I'm sure, continue talking for the rest of the day, maybe. But you've been very, very generous with your time already. We've been talking for quite some time, so let me just ask a final question, if I may. What's your next project? What are you working on now?
Well, I always work on too many things at one time. I'm sort of intellectually promiscuous, but I'm continuing to work right now on two main things. One is thinking more about human rights and about human rights institutions and their legitimacy or otherwise. And the other is this project that I call social moral epistemology. Mm-hmm. Social epistemology, as you know, is the comparative study of alternative institutions and practices so far as they influence the formation and transmission and preservation of true beliefs. And mm-hmm. social moral epistemology focuses on how social practices and institutions influence those of our beliefs that are especially critical for our moral functioning, for our making good moral judgments, moral arguments, having the right moral principles, having the virtues. And I've been working on this for a number of years. I've written probably 7 or 8 articles on it, but mm-hmm. now I'm trying to really get down to the difficult part and writing a book which will be systematic in its presentation of this topic. And I was stimulated really to do this by a couple of things. One was my own upbringing in Jim Crow South. I grew up in Little Rock, Arkansas, and at a certain point, just through moral luck, I realized that all of the people that I trusted, my parents and my pastor and government officials and teachers, had been filling my little head with systematically distorted views about race.
Right.
And so, I just saw this huge apparatus for instilling morally damaging false beliefs. And then the second thing that prompted me was reading Jonathan Glover's wonderful book, Humanity, A Moral History of the 20th Century, where he makes the case that a primary task for ethicists is to try to understand the massive wrongdoings of the 20th century, the genocides, the world wars, and then say something constructive about how to reduce the risk that this kind of thing will continue to happen. And I think part of the strategy for reducing the risk is to understand social moral epistemology.
Right, right. Well, that project on social epistemology is particularly of interest to me, given some of my own interests. So I will definitely look forward to that. And maybe when some of that work comes out, we will invite you back to talk to us about it on New Books in Philosophy. But for now, let me again thank you so much for your time. The book is Better Than Human. Thank you so much, Alan Buchanan, for talking to me about your book.
Thank you, Bob, and thank you for a really astute interview. You're very well informed. I've had lots of interviews on this subject, and some of them haven't compared at all to yours.
Well, I appreciate that. Thanks. Have a good day now.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
You have been listening to my interview with Professor Alan Buchanan of Duke University. We've been talking about his new book, Better Than Human, published by Oxford University Press. I'm Robert Talese, your host. This is New Books in Philosophy. Thank you for listening.